You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 16th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Tamara Drop, VP of Policy and Research at Demos, on her book, Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. Meanwhile, looks like we may not, let me rephrase that, we won't not have little Marco to kick around anymore. He may be back, in other words. Also, congratulations, folks. May breaks the record for the warmest month in the history of May's.
Fantastic job, everyone.
Yes, and we are now 5 out of 5 for 2016. 5 records shattered in terms of global warming. But by all means, let's just move on. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton continuing to widen her lead against Donald Trump. And Trump's hacked DNC Oppo file released. I think that was like an early draft. Trump also breaking the hearts of John Kasich, and Paul Ryan, and all the Republicans. Is it all going to lead to Trump news? Meanwhile, Democrats involved in a 15-hour filibuster last night forces a vote on 2 gun control measures. We'll dig into that. We've talked about them in the past. And the family of the man who invented the AR-15, let me paraphrase, says to the ammosexuals who on Twitter or call into the show complain, you don't know what you're talking about, assault rifle. Actually, that you're full of crap.
That's a tremendous impression.
Yeah. There's nothing that annoys me more than the stream of ammosexuals that I get in my Twitter feed who think that that there's no argument. You can't engage in an argument about gun control unless you know the specific calibers of the AR-15 as modified by the Sig Sauer manufacturer production line.
You don't understand it because you're not a gun owner.
Honestly, and then you get these guys who their variant, I'm not going to say his name because we're not allowed to take his name in vain, but of his fans, the one who shall not be and cannot be named
the
because he cannot be
people.
Understood, cannot be understood, who was, I got sucked into this, of course, because Andy Kindler was responding to him, because apparently the one who cannot be understood was misunderstood by a Trump supporter, thinking that he had called Trump a Hitler. And this sort of conflated with him saying, what the cause was not the gun of this shooting. The cause was something else, and then leaves it hanging out there for everyone to come up. And his answer is not the raging insanity and homophobia of this guy and steroid addiction and whatnot. It's something else, something that's inherently problematic. But nevertheless, somehow, out of that tweet, when I wrote to the one who cannot be named, I think there's a good argument that the cause of those deaths had to do with a near assault weapon. And of course I say near because I know all these homosexuals are going to say, what do you mean by assault weapon? Define it. Define assault weapon. You can't even talk about this. Yeah, these are the same people who will talk about any other political issue based upon headlines they've taken from YouTube as a determinant as to what their research is going to constitute, right? They'll say, oh, Social Security is bankrupt. Oh, really? Do you even know what the Social Security trustee report is? Obviously propaganda. You know, but when it comes to like talking about guns, you need to be able to pack your own bullets. You need to be able to construct your own bullets. It's like saying, you know, we should have some environmental protections. Do you tie your own flies for fishing? Well, then you can't comment on this. Well, the family of the AR-15 inventor, Eugene Stoner, came out with didn't make a release, but they were interviewed last night by Tony DeCoupel. Our father, Eugene Stoner, designed the AR-15 and subsequent M16 as a military weapon to give our soldiers an advantage over the AK-47. He died long before any mass shootings occurred, but we do think he would have been horrified and sickened as anyone, if not more, by these events. They requested individual anonymity to speak freely about such a sensitive topic. In other words, we're afraid of the wackos out there, and we're just happy to have them just tweet Sam Cedar and other people. They go on to say that their father was an ex-Marine. He was an avid sportsman, hunter, and skeet shooter, but never used his invention for sport. He never even kept it around the house for personal defense, never owned one. After many conversations with him, we feel his intent was that he designed it as a military rifle, his family said. He designed the original AR-15 in the late 50s, working on in his own garage and later as chief designer for Armalite, which was then a small company in Southern California. He fashioned a new bullet for it that's 223 caliber. And the Army loved it and renamed it the M16. After his death in 97, a semi-automatic version of the AR-15 became a civilian bestseller too. And they, and that, of course, has a smaller caliber. Although the bullets used in Orlando were the 223 rounds. And apparently, they lament the fact that the patents expired, because once the patents expired, you had all these gun companies that used that patent to build variants of it. So for all you homosexuals out there, in the words of the great thinker, Thomas Friedman, suck on that. Suck on that. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Tamara Drought about her book, Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Hey, just want to remind people that we have an app. My neighbor told me to remind people. We have an app that is free. You can go to majorityapp.com. to get it. And if you're having problems on the app for whatever reason, go to today's blog post and re-log in with your credentials at our majority.fans.fm site. It's our new provider for our member feed. And if you have a problem on the app. And also, I should also remind you, because apparently my neighbor, who is a tech whiz, didn't even realize this. You have a choice on our app. You can either download the show by pressing on the arrow next to the words that are written, or you can just stream the show as a podcast after the show is over by just hitting the words. So we got that out of the way. On the phone, want to welcome to the program Tamara Drought. She is the Vice President of Policy and Research at Demos, author of her latest, Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. Tamara, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, all right, let's start off with sort of the obvious question, but not necessarily the obvious answer, because we've heard a lot about the working class in this, particularly in this election, but also we're hearing a lot more about it over the past several years as we talk about things like wealth inequality and lagging wages relative to productivity, et cetera. Who is the working class as you define it?
Sure. So I talk about the new working class, and the new working class is largely people who work in professions of either serving or caring. So think about that in contrast to the old working class, people like my dad. We still think when you hear the terms working class of like blue collar, white man, you know, steel-toed boots, hard hats, people like my dad who worked in a steel factory. Today's new working class is much more female, and it's much more people of color. And as opposed to making stuff, they earn their living serving people. And just as it's been throughout our history, you know, America is really a working class nation. I define the working class as people who don't have four-year college degrees, and that is and will continue to be the majority of people in this country. So we are a working class nation, but our politics and our culture don't reflect that reality very much anymore, and especially in contrast to, you know, the heyday of working class power in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
So what have been the forces that have created that transformation? I mean, there's some sort of, I think, obvious things. Manufacturing has left this country to a large extent. We have an aging population. So when we talk about that sector of workers who care for us, the health sector, I guess, largely speaking, that becomes big. So what has happened that has changed beyond those factors? What has changed the nature of the working class? Has the working class, is it the same size? It's just that the makeup is different. What has actually happened?
So it's about 2/3 of the country right now. So it's a little smaller than it used to be because overall college attainment has increased. More people have bachelor's degrees. But increasingly, there's a couple things that have changed sort of the demographic composition of the working class. One, women's labor force participation is much higher than it used to be. And so this new working class is much more female, and the jobs are much more in the caring and serving sector than they were a generation ago. And the other thing that has happened is demographic change in the form of immigration. So we now have a working class population that is disproportionately Latino. That was not the case in the 1970s. And then as more whites have gotten bachelor's degrees, it means that the proportion of the working class that is African-American has also increased in its size. So those are the big factors that have really changed sort of who this new working class is.
Is there a significant, is, you know, when you talk about younger people of color or white, for that matter, who have gotten 4-year college degrees, but are not are having trouble entering the labor force in the context of those, you know, I guess, white collar jobs or managerial or the information, technology jobs. I mean, do they constitute any significant numbers within what you're talking about, or are they automatically excluded because of their education?
Well, in the book, they're excluded because of their education. But my first book, which came out 10 years ago, called Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead, actually really focused on the plight of a new generation coming of age, you know, at a time of great inequality and at a time where our public policy has just not at all addressed the reality of, you know, we have a broken debt for diploma system in terms of access to higher education. Wages across the board have been down compared to what their fathers earned a generation ago. So absolutely. And there are lots of professions, adjunct faculty come to mind,
right,
where you have a very well-educated workforce who often, you know, in terms of being paid by the class and all of the work that comes with teaching those courses, you know, ultimately end up making around the equivalent of minimum wage or just a little higher above minimum wage. So I think of the college educated, recent graduates, the millennials, often are in temporary working class status in terms of not able to get onto a career path. But if you really compare the living standards, the quality of jobs, the unemployment rate, any indicator, we have a great divergence between those with bachelor's degrees and those without. You know, that gap in quality of life was much more narrow in the 70s than it is today.
So, I mean, that's why I'm just trying to get to, I want to sort of segue into sort of the notion of class consciousness. And that's why I guess I'm getting a nitpicky on how you determine that, because the quality of life also sort of suggests that perhaps the people that we're talking, you know, that second group, right, like the adjunct professors et al, or the people who have a 4-year bachelor's degree and are working at as a barista or something, it suggests that they come from families that are better off, or what, or that they're ultimately 10, 15 years down the road, they're going to figure out, they're going to be they're not going to be in those same jobs. Is that the idea?
Yeah. I mean, I want to be really clear. I mean, I have great sympathy for, and it is a real problem that many college graduates are leaving with. You know, today the average is $35,000 in student loan debt, and they're not immediately getting jobs that put them, you know, on a professional career track. That being said, in the aggregate, having a college degree does still sort of buttress you from the harshest realities of our economy today. You are much more likely to be paid an annual salary than wages, for example. So there is this, you know, there's always exceptions on both sides.
Right.
But we really have seen a pretty sharp division in quality of life between people with bachelor's degrees and those without. And just to make it personal, a good example is I grew up in a household where neither of my parents had college degrees, but we were actually, you know, part of the what is now an extinct class in America, a blue-collar middle class by lifestyle, in terms of they could pay full freight for my tuition at a state college. I graduated in 4 years without debt. We could do things like take vacations every year. You know, my dad had a generous pension. We always had health care. We always had enough food in the fridge. Those are things that today's working class, people who don't have college degrees, by and large, can no longer achieve on their wages.
And I should mention in the context of your book, that juxtaposition comes up quite a bit. I mean, you talk about your father's life trajectory and contrast it to what I guess his analog would be today, what access they would have, and the distinction between your father having the ability to get health care because of his blue collar job versus the people actually providing it in many instances and what their situation is today. So let's talk about the sleeping giant part about it, because part of what your book covers, at least on to some degree, is a sort of a level of consciousness of the way that people identify themselves as being part of the working class, and what that what the implications of that are. So, I mean, just tell us about what has something changed in terms of the way that the new working class perceives themselves.
Well, you know, I think it's starting to change. One of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to really re-inject working class back into our lexicon. It has kind of disappeared, except for every 4 years during the presidential election. We talk about the working class, but when we're talking about the working class then, we're really talking about whites, and particularly white men in the working class. So we need to bring back this, we need to use the words working class. The reality is nearly half of all Americans identify as working class, and about another half identify as middle class. And African Americans and Latinos and women are much more likely to self-identify as working class. So we're really not speaking to people's experiences and identity when we scrub the term working class out of our political lexicon. That being said, I do think something is happening, and I point to three durable movements that are of, by, and for the working class, and that is Black Lives Matter, the Fight for 15, and the Dreamers, who are the young undocumented immigrants who have been very successful in bringing some dignity to our immigration laws. So I do think there's a developing class consciousness. I think that particularly in Fight for 15, you see a working class solidarity that is cutting across race and gender. That hasn't happened in a very long time and is hard to maintain. But I think it is sort of the greatest hope of a renewed working class solidarity. And, you know, just to inject into our politics, what we're seeing today is with the rise of Trump is a longstanding strategic use to divide the working class by race in order to sort of snuff out any kind of economic solidarity. So I'm encouraged by the growth and success of these three movements and what they mean in terms of this new working class reclaiming some of its economic and political power.
So, I mean, so there's two dynamics, or let me ask you about two dynamics. So one is, let's take that one that you just mentioned about Trump first. Is part of the reason why that's not necessarily going to be effective, and I think there's been some data to suggest that, in fact, Donald Trump is not necessarily reaching those people that ostensibly he gets credit for reaching. That at least in the context of the Republican race, he was appealing to people who were making more than, let's say, your average Cruz voter in many instances. But leaving that aside, is part of the reason why it may not be effective what Trump is doing insofar as dividing the working class, because those lines it's not so much, you know, if he was to peel off, let's say, a certain percentage of the white working class, the fact is that the working class is substantially more of color. And that, frankly, that's not going to work anymore, right? Like, you can't peel that off on racial lines in the same way anymore.
Yeah, I think, and thank you for pointing out that he's getting more credit than the reality of who is voting for him, because I think you're absolutely right. His appeal has skewed to a little higher income. So I think what you see is the Democratic Party with Clinton and Sanders, but particularly Clinton, getting the votes of the new working class women and people of color, male and female. She's really winning those voters. And, you know, Trump is getting a you know, not unsizable percentage of the old working class who is traditionally, you know, non-college educated white men. That seems to be a significant part of his support. It's not the totality of his support. But, you know, the fascinating thing about what we're going to have in the general election is in terms of the working class, is Trump appealing to the old working class, the part that is shrinking and has been shrinking for a long time, and Clinton, who's appealing really to this new working class, which is growing and will continue to grow as a percentage of the electorate.
Do you think part of the reason why those type of the sort of the, you know, the mythical perception of the working class, or that the perception of the working class as what the old working class was, has something to do with our media? I mean, because whenever we hear, and I only watch English speaking news because I only speak English, as much as I regret that, I speak a couple of pigeon words, but that's not the point. The point being that, you know, when we hear the perception of the working class, there is almost a default that it's the white lunchbox guy, a lunchbox guy who's got the hard hat on, those guys only exist in the minds of a lot of like the people in our media, because maybe it was their parents, maybe that's just what they saw on television. But the reality is so much different from that. I mean, do you think and it seems to me that's going to be a very hard thing to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an enduring image. And I think it comes from both pulp culture and from sort of, you know, the white blue-collar man was sort of the face of the working class, the blue-collar working class, and the union man. And one of the problems with the new working class is it doesn't have that center of gravity the way manufacturing and blue-collar work was for my dad's generation of working class. You know, today's, you know, would the typical working class person be a Latina home health care aide or a Latino janitor or a black retail worker? You know, there's such a mix of different kinds of jobs and occupations that it's hard to sort of give it a stereotype.
Right.
The other thing is, you know, the working class, and I talk about this in the book, has pretty much disappeared from our televisions, right? Like if you think back in the 70s, most of the popular sitcoms at the time all focused on the working class. Good Times, One Day at a Time, Alice, Archie Bunker. Today, the working class is gone from television, and in fact, most of the popular shows are, you know, very urbane and really feature, regardless of race, very upper and upper middle class storylines. So the working class as a whole, I would argue, as it has become more female and more people of color, has been sort of erased from our cultural fabric, and that's both in the news media and in you know, entertainment television.
Yeah, and I think part of that, frankly, is a function of who populates the media in terms of working there. I mean, this is we're a little bit off topic here, but you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, the people writing these television shows now, as opposed to the era that you're talking about, come from a very distinctly different background. In terms of socioeconomic. I mean, now, you know, most of those shows now are written by Ivy League grads, is the reality. And
I make that point in the book, because that's what has happened. You know, if you think about it, we had a huge gain in education among the baby boomers back when you could actually work a minimum wage job and pay your way through college. And all those baby boomers sent their own kids to college, and now it's become a debt for diploma system. So we're actually replicating privilege through our higher ed system. And what that means is that today's journalists, today's TV writers and producers are much more likely to come from a family with a college-educated background.
Indeed. And all right, so I want to also ask about you. You mentioned that it's also an additional hurdle is the idea that it's difficult to stereotype, right? Because you have such a disparate type of worker in different sectors. And part of also what makes, I think, sort of the level of class consciousness or an obstacle to that is that, you know, as opposed to those men who are working in a factory who literally, as part of actually having to do their work, had to learn to work together and would work together. You have these jobs, home healthcare workers or service industry jobs, which are not at all like that. Both sort of like physically they're in a different space, but also the type of work is such that it's not like, you know, three people are maybe, I guess, you know, when you're talking about food service, but home health care, these people are basically soloists. And we saw this came to the fore with Harris v. Quinn, which was that Supreme Court case that I hope folks remember about the attempt to unionize these workers. And the Supreme Court sort of struck it down on the technicality that they were not actually, you
full
know,
public employees.
Exactly.
Right?
But the so, I mean, talk about how these disparate groups create a sense of solidarity and an awareness of where they fit in the spectrum of things, because they don't see it necessarily reflected in the media. And I'm curious, is like, how much does things like social media change the landscape where we have the ability now through technology to create a sort of third space where we can gather based upon these sort of, I don't want to get too buzzwordy, but like psychographic similarities.
Yeah, so let me get in one thing that we haven't talked about, because I actually think it's really important to class consciousness, and it's one of the reasons it has fallen off among this new working class, and that is unionization. You know, as we lost the unionized manufacturing jobs and the lower-paying service sector jobs took their place, you know, the percentage of people who are in union households has plummeted. And unions not only deliver, you know, better wages and working conditions and benefits for their members, they also spend a lot of time in developing, you know, political and class consciousness. Political education is a key part of being a union member. And so that function that it served for, you know, the old manufacturing working class is not as large as it as today for today's new working class. That said, I think you're right about social media. I mean, if you look at all of the movements that I've talked about, Black Lives Matter, Fight for 15, the Dreamers, you know, social media has been very important to building bigger rallies, bigger protest movements. It enables people to lend their support even if they can't hit the streets at a certain date and time. So I think it has really helped lift up these movements in a way that, you know, would have been impossible a generation ago.
All right, so let's talk about some of the biggest obstacles, I guess. Well, I mean, I guess we've touched on that in terms of the difficulty in creating that class consciousness and unionizing. But to what extent does the sort of, I guess, hybrid unions create a new, I guess, vehicle for this? You know, like we know that the Fight for 15 is sort of like, I don't know how you would describe that, really. I mean, it's union supported. It's not fully union. I mean, is this a is that a structure that is sustainable or has durability?
So I think what's happening right now in the labor movement is pretty exciting, where you have lots of different kinds of organizing happening. I think people are starting to think about, you know, membership organizations as opposed to official unions. So you could see the Fight for 15 becoming some kind of worker membership organization. But absolutely, you know, we also have lawsuits that are underway right now trying to establish McDonald's as an example, as a joint employer. You know, most McDonald's locations are owned by franchises. And McDonald's has basically said, you know, we don't have a say over working conditions in our stores. We don't set the wages. We don't set, but they actually have a lot of sway, and their franchise contracts are so detailed. So right now, the NLRB has ruled that in cases like McDonald's, the parent company actually is jointly responsible for the employment of everybody in their franchise stores. It is, of course, being fought in the courts. But if that ends up holding and companies like McDonald's are held to be jointly responsible for the employees in all of their stores, that means that a union like SEIU can then bring McDonald's to the table and actually collectively bargain for all of it, all of the workers, instead of having to go store by store by store. So that would be a game changer. And the Restaurant Association certainly knows that and is doing everything it can to try and not have that happen.
Right. They're fighting that. I mean, I just I think I read a piece today, too, that Microsoft is actually sort of weighing into that ostensibly because it would inhibit some type of corporate social responsibility programs. And I give me this. I mean, I'm just this is a sideline, too, but maybe you have a better understanding of this. But why would Microsoft have a problem with this, aside from the fact that they're afraid that corporate social responsibility programs? I'm sure.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it that are they basically saying, like, look, if you do this in the context of, I mean, are they selling software to restaurants? I mean, what is it that is really driving their opposition to this?
That is a really good question, because I saw that article as well, and I immediately thought, this is odd. I don't have an answer off the top of my head, but I think you're right to ask the question, because there's something kind of suspicious and not exactly right about it. Because, you know, as the article mentioned, you know, Microsoft did the right thing. It has lots of contractors. For example, it's janitorial staff. And instead of just saying, well, we don't hire them, which is true, you know, they subcontract that out, they've set new standards for their subcontractors to pay those workers a decent wage. And, you know, that's another strategy that big global corporations use all the time to sort of shift accountability, is to just subcontract, and then that subcontractor subcontracts, and then nobody is seemingly responsible for what ends up to be, you know, often law-breaking, deplorable working conditions. So I think, you know, this is just resetting the basic standard of accountability for corporations and businesses that employ people here in the United States of America. And because it has frayed for so, you know, for decades now at this point, it is going to be a huge adjustment. But it's one that as a nation, we definitely need to recalibrate and hold these companies responsible for all of the contractors and direct hires they have.
Yeah, if people have a theory about the Microsoft thing, they can email
me. Yeah, let us hear it.
Because I would be interested. I mean, in the back of my head, I sort of feel like, does this have anything to do with sort of, I don't know, educational products? You know, like, I just wonder, like, what business they're, I don't know. I can't, but it just seems like, wow, that is really, they're coming, are they really afraid of corporate social responsibility programs being threatened? And obviously not their own, right? I mean, they're doing this.
Yeah, it seems like a real stretch.
Yeah, it seems
a
little bit
of a stretch.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about what you suggest that we need to do in terms of providing for the this new working class. I mean, obviously there are narrow policy prescriptions, but structurally and systemically, like, what needs to change to address this new reality?
So much. So I put together a blueprint, and Demos will sometime in the summer and early fall be really putting meat on the bones of what is just, you know, sort of a summary sketch of what I call a better deal. And I think it really is a comprehensive blueprint, both to, you know, deal with the erosion of labor protections for workers, to provide paid sick days and parental leave, to finally raise the minimum wage and the sub-minimum wage for tip workers. So there's a whole piece around just dealing with workplace issues. And then, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about helping families be good parents and good workers. You know, the United States is pretty much alone in the world in not providing paid leave, and among advanced nations, not providing any kind of universal access to high-quality, affordable child care. And so, you know, it was great to see Clinton come out and make a bold demand that nobody should have to spend more than 10% on child care, and that would help so many working-class families, particularly single parents who, you know, combined with erratic scheduling, makes it very hard for them to hold down a job and also be a parent. And then finally, I talk about democracy reforms. You know, one of the big challenges this new working class faces in amassing political power is just the tide of corporate and private money in our political system. So we need public financing of elections, and we need to really transform the way the Supreme Court views money in politics, so that money is no longer considered free speech and corporations are no longer considered people. And then finally, I talk a lot in the book, as throughout the book, about race. And I think that as a nation, the progress we need to make to really improve the lives of everybody in our country, we need to really get serious about tackling the legacy and the ongoing effects of racism and unconscious bias in this country. We have never fully dealt with the history of race and never made any attempts at, you know, real reparative justice, because it shows up very deeply in our society today. And we have to finally deal with that.
What, I mean, I would imagine at a time like this, right, where you are at a, you're at a left, I think, or left leaning or think tank.
Yeah.
That you're watching, you see the polls, right? And you see Donald Trump could obviously, and nothing's, you know, we're a ways out and whatnot, but that, if I had to bet, certainly my kid's college education right now, and I had two choices, and it was Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, I would be betting Hillary Clinton at this point. And also I would bet, you know, based upon what we're seeing in the Republican Party, that you may have a Democratic Senate, less likely about a House, but it's not inconceivable. What are the big things, like structural things? I mean, I hear your list here of various policy proposals, some of which could theoretically be, you know, done by executive order or by agencies, you know, and by the sort of totality, I guess, of appointments to federal courts. But what is the big structural thing? I mean, is there an equivalent to, let's say, card check that is out there in the idea people on the left are contemplating that would have a structural impact, so that the rest of these this list of things that need to happen would happen that much more easily, because it would increase the power of these people? I mean, I hear money in politics, but is there something more oriented towards unions that maybe we haven't heard of before, or that people are going to renew their push for?
Well, card check is certainly on that list. I don't want to get away from money in politics, because I actually think that it is vitally important that we structurally fix the way we finance elections in this country, and we really restrict the amount of private money in the system. It influences the entire sort of political pipeline in terms of who runs for office, who gets elected, what issues they care about. You know, the reality, particularly on economic policy, is that the donor class is much more conservative than the general public, and particularly working class voters. You know, you can't even get among donors half of the donor population to agree that the minimum wage should be high enough so that a family doesn't live in poverty. They're also less likely to support investments in higher education, so you don't have to take on debt. So we have a real, real barrier with the way our political system is currently structured, and we need to address that. On the labor thing, you know, this is an idea that nobody has proposed, and probably because it's would be a really big fight. But, you know, we have right to work laws, you know, that prohibit and drag down wages in, you know, the southern part of the country. And we have more and more jobs moving to the southern part of the country where they can get away with low wages and don't really have to face a viable union attempt. So if we could go back and amend Taft-Hartley and prohibit the ability to have right-to-work laws, which really stemmed from the Jim Crow South wanting to maintain its racial wage hierarchy, that would be a big change, because then the entire country would be on the same playing field in terms of ability to unionize workers.
Interesting. And lastly, let me ask you one more question about Is there a tension in the Democratic Party, or will there become one, as we see and we're seeing a little evidence of this, that like the white suburban upper middle class, if you will, professional class, mm-hmm. is now becoming increasingly a Democratic constituency, right? Mm-hmm. Over the past 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, certainly they've been pursued for an extended period of time, mm-hmm. but things like issues of race, things like the environment, social, you know, marriage equality. These things are cleaving off these sort of former Republican voters, right? These what we used to call moderate Republican voters,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they're becoming a more reliable Democratic constituency. Obviously, they're coming with more money. What's that going to do? I mean, are we seeing, you know, are we going to see that tension? Is that going to play out more as we go forward in time?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I think what we're seeing so far is a little bit of the opposite, where you actually have the Democratic Party moving more left and paying more attention to the Latino vote, the African American vote, and the women's vote. And I think those groups tend to have more liberal, particularly on economic policy, positions. And I think you're seeing less of a strategic moderation aimed at reaching suburban voters. I think Democrats in general have been, you know, socially progressive and socially liberal. So I don't think those suburban voters who vote Democratic, nothing has really changed in that regard. I think what's changing is we're seeing a much more full-throated, you know, attempt at a little bit of populism in the Democratic Party, and a little bit finally shedding its very sort of pro-business, anti-welfare, anti-government triangulation that really happened, you know, as a response to the Democratic Party losing in the 70s and 80s.
I hope you're right about that. I mean, I'm not convinced that, you know, sort of the appeals that we've seen, that the appeals directly that have brought out those different, I think, value sets quite yet. I'm curious though where we go with that, but I hope you're right.
Yeah, and I think it'll become starker once we get to the general election.
I mean, I don't. Are we even going to have time to talk about those things? I mean, honestly, like, I mean, I'm not being facetious about that. Like, it occurs to me that it's quite possible this entire election may never get to actually even discussing these broader issues. That it may just be a series of like, holy crap, look what he said today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's definitely, I think, Trump's strategy.
But do you think that's also possibly? This isn't necessarily
Debate,
portfolio,
right?
Right.
Like there, you know, unless Trump again, you know, breaks with tradition and protocol and refuses to debate, which I can't imagine would happen. You know, so we're going to have debates. You know, they're going to be 90 minutes, and that's going to have to. You know, he can't run away from substance in a debate. I don't think. At some point, he's going to have to say something about what his real proposals are.
I hope so. I mean, I hope that's also
he
the case.
He doesn't want to.
Well,
but
I hope that's also the case for our Democratic nominee, too. I mean, because it certainly, I mean, on some level, I know that if I wanted to make an argument with Donald Trump, it would be a lot about him. And if I don't have to say anything that's going to alienate anybody, other than this guy's a wacko, that's the route that I might take. But maybe that's why people shouldn't nominate me.
Well, you know, I think Clinton is finding her voice right now in terms of going after Trump. And I think it's getting much more strong and much more direct. And, you know, she's really questioning explicitly his psychological fitness for this job.
Right. So, but I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, because are we going to hear the type of proactive agenda that is looking to create more systemic and or even policy changes, mm-hmm. Of the kind that you're talking about, yep. when that may not even be necessary from the perspective of from Clinton's perspective, when you can just say, when you can just find a voice to attack Donald Trump. In other words, like, look, if yep. I'm the nominee, well, the last yep. thing I want to do is to actually take a position on anything, because that can be used against me or hem me in the future. And so Donald Trump, in some ways, I mean, and it's unfortunate, provides an easy way to avoid taking certain positions beyond what you've already taken, mm-hmm. because the whole campaign could be like, look at this lunatic.
Well, I think... you know, I'm assuming that Clinton's going to be the Democratic nominee. You know, she's already put out lots of pretty substantive policy proposals, from child care to achieving debt-free college to criminal justice. So I don't think that, you know, on the Democratic side, it'll just be a switch to attacking Trump. As much as that needs to be a part of it, we also need to give people a reason to vote right. for the Democratic nominee, not just against Trump.
Tamara Drought, the book is Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot, Sam.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, folks. Now it's time to head into the fun half. What? Oh, yeah. The we teased this up front. I don't know. I've heard mixed reports as to whether or not it has anything to do with Brexit. But earlier today, I guess in British time, an MP, a woman named Jo Cox, was shot, and the story is unclear to me that she was she got involved in a fight on the street that may have been about leaving or not leaving the EU. She has died, according to CNN International, anyways. That's sad news. There's a lot of anger over this, over what's happening in terms of whether or not Great Britain exits the EU. And we got a bunch of emails from British listeners and some who I think would perceive themselves as British subjects on some level. And it is interesting. I think, you know, we heard, I think, the broad strokes from Matthias Matisse the other day, which, if you have not listened to that, I would go back and listen to. I mean, I think it is, you cannot get a better, at least basic understanding from where we are on what's going on there and the potential implications. But there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of other cross currents that are harder for us to pick up, if not only because we don't have the sort of the basic on the ground understanding, but, it seems from at least some of the emails that we've gotten that support for the exit comes from the English as opposed to the Irish or the Scottish or the Welsh. And that there are some, particularly Scots, who seem to welcome the idea that perhaps Great Britain exits, England stays out. And Scotland and perhaps these other countries head back in and Great Britain becomes a little bit less great. But interesting other dynamic to it. And, at another time where we weren't looking at the complete lunacy that our politics have become, but we would be able to, I think, maybe spend more time and get into a little bit of nuance there. But we will know the result of that vote in 6 days. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Folks, it's your membership that makes this show possible, day in, day out. Whenever you become a Majority Report member, an angel gets their wing. And some ammo sexual gets a bad tweet from me. Maybe that's what we should do. Like, we should tweet it out. We should tweet it out every time we get a new member. What if we can do that, like, with a bot?
Dude.
A new member.
Just get, like, a member bot, and it'll just be like, dude, we just got a new bot. Take that, you, what is it?
Member bot?
Ammosexual guy. Nerd with a gun.
Boom.
Potential mass shooter. We just got a new member.
Yeah, new member.
You suck.
JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Don't want to buy crap from Amazon? Buy it through Jet.com at our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. All right, headed to the fun house.